This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to senior editor Trent Gilliss's interview with Elpidophorus lambriniatus. He is Metropolitan of Bursa. This interview took place on June 17, 2012, at the Monastery of the Holy Trinity on the island of Heybeliada in Turkey. Download the MP3 of our produced show at onbeing.org.
Personal faith in God and the people around you. So I'm going to set this up here, but
how long do you want that? Because we don't have much time.
15 minutes.
Okay.
Is that acceptable?
It's okay.
First thing, maybe you could just tell me if you could pronounce your name for us so we
can. Can I give you my card so
of
it's easier?
And then I'll have you say.
My name is Elpidophorus. Elpidophorus, and I'm Metropolitan of Bursa. Bursa is a city in the south coast of the Marmara Sea, south from Istanbul.
Yes, and why is that significant within the
well,
title?
Everybody, every archbishop has his own diocese. It's not that significant, but it's my diocese. I don't think it's a significant diocese, but it's my responsibility, my jurisdiction as a bishop.
And not only are you the bishop of the Archdiocese of Bursa, but you're also the abbot of this monastery?
Exactly, because in the year 1922, if you know from the history, that there, after the war between Greece and Turkey, there was an exchange of populations between the two countries. And in the framework of this exchange of populations, all Greeks living outside Istanbul had to go to Greece. And vice versa, all Turks living in Greece had to come to Turkey. So we lost the vast majority of our flock in Asia Minor, Pontus, and all this historical Christian soil. After that year, 1922, we keep, of course, our dioceses. We elect bishops for these dioceses, but they have no faithful anymore. Things change. We have now Christians living there, but we have no organized communities because of that historical fact that happened like 90 years ago. And since 18 months, I was elected and consecrated as bishop of this city. And after my consecration, I visited the whole area, the city and the area, the dependencies of the city that belong to the historical jurisdiction of the Diocese of Bursa. I found out some Christian churches still being there as buildings, as ruined churches. Some of them belong to the state, some of them belong to private persons, their private properties. Some of them are renovated as cultural centers. Some of them are used by animals. It's in a very bad condition. Some of them just collapsing. Mm-hmm. And what I am doing right now to accomplish my duty as a bishop of this area, I approach the owners of the private church buildings, and I negotiate with them to buy these private properties. Some of them are very historical, very old churches. Two of them are Byzantine churches. One, it belongs to the 8th century. It's a huge, beautiful church of the archangels Michael and Gabriel. The other is Virgin Mary's church from the 14th century. So I collected some money from sponsors and donors from around the world, Christians, and I managed already to buy one of the two churches from the 14th century, and we are in the procedure now to renovate the church and to function it again as a church. There are some Christians, but not in the same way that they existed in the past. There are Christians, immigrants from other countries, from Romania. There are Orthodox Christians from Ukraine working in the factories of Bursa, because the Bursa has heavy automobile industry and other forms of industries. There are some even Greeks. I met at least two Greek women married to Turkish men living in Bursa, but they keep, of course, their religion. They are Christian Orthodox. And I'm sure if we start a church there, more people will appear, and at least one community will be able to be established and composed.
So I never thought
this is concerning my diocese as Bursa.
Well, I never thought of it that way, is that with all the talk about the majority Muslim population and state and the politics, that it may be migration that is the rebirth of the Orthodox Church within Turkey, or the growth?
There is another example even better than my diocese. It's the example of Antalya. Antalya is a very touristic place in Turkey. And there we did the same thing. We bought a church. We established an old Greek Orthodox church. We renovated it, and now it's we have a parish there, a living parish. We calculate that in the area of Antalya live today 15,000 Russian Orthodox having the Turkish passport. This changes history. It's a huge evolution in the history of Christianity in Asia Minor. So our priest there in Antalya is a Russian-speaking priest. He's celebrating the liturgies and the services in Old Church Slavonic. So Ukrainians, Russians, and all Slavic origin Orthodox who live now permanently in Antalya, they attend this church. This is how we see the future of Christianity in this area. Of course, we are sometimes very romantic. We see the history, how Christianity grew up here with the church fathers of the Cappadocia and recent Christianity, the Greek Orthodox Christianity, which left this area only 90 years ago. But we have to be flexible and see the future in the new way, without having these memories. Of course, we have the memories, but these memories cannot be a burden for the future of our faith in this country.
So how does that, as you oversee your diocese and also mm-hmm. interact with other bishops, the flavor of the church changes, if you will, through the people and the migrants. How does it affect how you think about the church or what you go about doing?
You know that the faith is independent from the nationality and the origin of the people. The people of God is people of God, whatever they are as nation or as cultural background. Especially in the United States, you know this better than anywhere else. We are now experiencing this in the old world, where migration changes nature of the parishes of the Christianity and the understanding of faith and living communities together. This for us is a new experience, but we are ready to face it and to accept it and to go forward with it without any complexes, if I may say, without any hesitations, because we are the Ecumenical Patriarchate here. We are not the Greek Patriarchate. So having this cultural richness and background as a Ecumenical Patriarchate, we have no difficulty to go forward with any new given historical situations that God allows to happen. It is not, I can give you an example of the history of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. For example, before the exchange of populations, almost the whole population Greek Orthodox population living in Cappadocia were Turkish-speaking people. They couldn't read or speak Greek. So what the Ecumenical Patriarchy did was to publish translations of all prayer books, of the Gospel, and all necessary liturgical books translated in Turkish language. And all services were held in Turkish language. That was not a problem for us. So even that, this is why today it is not a problem for us to have communities in Antalya celebrating in Church Slavonic. Even in Istanbul, we have, under the jurisdiction of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, we have Russian communities. We have Bulgarian communities. We have Antiochian communities. And very, very recently, like 8 years ago, we established a Romanian parish in Istanbul for the Romanians living in Istanbul. And we ask priests from Romania. The Patriarchate of Romania appoints a priest, who is now a priest of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, and he is serving here the Romanian minority in Istanbul. So we are the Ecumenical Patriarchate, very familiar with this kind of situations, and we are very optimistic for the future of Christianity in our jurisdiction, in this country and throughout the world.
So the term ecumenical isn't just a title.
No,
it's a way of living out.
It's a living reality for us.
We just spoke to a Dominican brother in Istanbul a couple of days ago, and he's been studying Islam and mysticism, as he's been studying that as part of his scholarship. He said that he used this phrase, Islamisms, that there's no one Islam, that there are Islams. And, wow. As I was thinking about it, in the States, we did a show several years ago when Pope Benedict XVI first made his first visit to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And part of it, there was a lot of stuff going on in the U.S., political and with the church and scandal. And we said, well, despite all that that's going on and all the press that's bad, we asked people, why did they stay? We got thousands of responses. And one of the things I learned through there is a lot of people said that the church means different things to them through their scholars, through Catholics. It could have been Graham Greene, a writer. It could be Thomas Aquinas. And I was just curious if, as you experience that, is there orthodoxisms, or if you will, or different ways of looking at orthodoxy in the church?
Being a member of a church doesn't mean that there is a uniformity of being a member of a church. There is no one norm of being Orthodox or of being Muslim or of being Roman Catholic or whatever. Where it is the human element, there are of course always some distinctions, differences, different flavors, different tastes of understanding the faith, whatever this faith is. Is it a Muslim faith, or is it a Christian faith, or is this denomination or the other denomination? Like in Christianity, we have many ways of living the faith, because the Spirit, when comes, when we pray for the Spirit, the fruit of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, is not one kind of fruit. There is a diversity of fruits of the Spirit. In the same way, in the other religions, I suppose there are different tendencies of ways of living the faith, depending on the culture of the of people, on the education, on the environment, of the political situation, of the way they live as Christians. For example, here in Turkey, we live our faith as a minority. And this defines the way we live the faith. In which way? It defines this in the way that we understand ourselves and the relation we have with God. And in the way we understand the church as institution or as a spiritual reality. When you are a minority, and you are a minority which was up to very recent years persecuted, literally, you see things different. You do not feel an institution, but as a living community, a community which needs members with solidarity, love, and support. Not only in this country, but you need the prayer of your brother in the States, in Europe, in Australia, in Canada. So this spirit that brings together all brothers and sisters of Christian faith together is for us necessary. For us here as Christians, nothing is given. We have to struggle for everything, even for the church that we have, the church building, even for the elementary human rights of education, for example. This school is a very good example of this problem with education right. It's a theological school of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, the first patriarchate in the Orthodox Church, and the only patriarchate deprived from the right to educate its own priests. So nothing is given. You have to struggle even for the minor, for the most elementary rights you have elsewhere.
It's a concentration of your faith.
Well, we, as I told you, we have to struggle even for the minor things that are so simply to find in the democratic countries and in other countries where Christianity is a majority.
So, what struck me is I was lucky enough, I'm from a state in the middle of the United States that's landlocked, but it has 10,000 lakes, but it's nothing like the sea. Uh-huh. And as I was sailing out here, I saw the monastery and theological school at the top of the hill. And first, maybe I'll ask you, what's the difference, how do you define the difference between a monastery and a theological school?
This is a monastery, primarily. This monastery was established in the 9th century. But in this monastery, in the 19th century, in the year 1844, the Ecumenical Patriarchate established a theological school within the monastery. The building was built for the purpose to host a theological school. Why? Because in the year 1894 there was a big earthquake which destroyed totally the building, and in the year, 2 years later, 1896, the big donor, Pavlos Skilitsis Stefanovic, whose picture is there, he sponsored the rebuild of this building for the purpose of the theological school already functioning in this monastery. So first was the monastery, and within the monastery was established the theological school. When the state forced us to close down the theological school, what remained was the monastery. This is why I am the abbot and not the dean of the theological school. But historically always, the dean and the abbot were the same person. This monastic character of the environment, of this environment, defined the theology and graduates, the spirit of the graduates of this school. They lived in a monastic environment as monks, as novices of a monastery, with daily prayer and services. So this defined the way they lived the faith and the way they understood theology. Our fathers, church fathers, say that you cannot be a theologian unless you pray right way. And if you pray in the right way, you are a true theologian. So prayer and theology belong together, and they are not separate from each other. And this signified the difference of our theology with the other theologies. The other characteristic of the graduate of this school is the fact that it was under the Ecumenical Patriarchate, and the graduates had always the spirit of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. What is the spirit of the Ecumenical Patriarchate? The spirit is the openness to the other, whoever this other is. Is this other another Christian, another denomination? Is another religion, another nation, another culture? Whatever it is, we are open to this. Open not in a syncretistic way, but open in a way of understanding the other and being able to live in peace with the other, without hostilities, without aggressiveness, without hesitations, without fear. But if you want to meet the other and have dialogue with the other, you must be confident and well equipped with your culture, with your theology, and all the education you need from your own religious, theological, and cultural background. If you are not well equipped, then when you meet the other, you are confused. And when you are confused, you are afraid. And when you are afraid, you are aggressive. And you go back to conservatism, which conservatism is an excuse for the fact that you cannot meet the other because you don't know your tradition well, or because you are unsafe how to meet him. But if you are well educated, if you are well equipped with your own theology, culture, language, you have no problem to face the other, whoever this other is. That's why we need graduates from this school having our spirit, whom we will send to throughout the world. We'll send to the United States of America. We have there a big diocese, to Canada, Hong Kong, to London, to Paris, to Berlin, to Australia. But we cannot send graduates of any theological school who will have theologians or clergy or priests who will not be able to have this openness of mind and have this good, well equipment of their own culture and tradition. So the purpose of this school was, on one side, to have the education, to create, to have theologians well educated, and since they are well educated, they must be open-minded to meet the other.
I once heard a rabbi talk about in the U.S. Say that in order to, because there's so many people that define themselves as spiritual but not religious, she said, before you leave a tradition, you should know it inside and out so you know what you're leaving, or you know what you're living. How is that, this ecumenism, how is that being lived out or played out within the monastery itself? Is there dialogue going on or different types of?
It is not the purpose of this monastery to hold the dialogue with the others. It's the ecumenical patriarchate in the headquarters of the patriarchate. We have official theological dialogues with all denominations. We have official dialogues with other religions, with Islam and Judaism.
How about within your diocese?
Well, it is not in my diocese. It is still so early to do that. As I told you, I'm appointed only 18 months now, and I am trying to first establish a church building to pray in. So it's not my first priority now. I have first to build my community, and then, of course, building the community, you can have dialogue. Of course, there is the dialogue of life. This is most important than the official theological or whatever dialogue we have among religions. What I mean, dialogue of life, is the good relations that I have with my neighbors in the area of the church I already purchased. The good dialogue we have with the mayor of the city, with the governor, with the imams. The first thing I did when I bought the church was, of course, to make a door, because it was open. There was no door in the church building. It's total ruined.
Where is this church at?
It is in Trilje. Trilje is a village close to Bursa, and there was this Byzantine church. The first thing I did when I built, when I constructed the door and I had the keys, is to give one key to the mayor. The other, the second key, I gave to the neighbors. And the third key I gave to the previous owner of the church. So everybody feels safe that I'm not a stranger who came in their village and just bought a building and closed it down and went away. This is the dialogue of life I am having in my diocese right now. But today we organize here again another dialogue that the Patriarch organized called Prominent Journalists of the Turkish Press. And in 1 hour there's a meeting here. The Patriarch will meet them. This is another sign, another example of the dialogue of life we have with the people we share our country, our life, our everyday experience.
So we just attended a 2.5 hour service about matins and
a long service. Well,
and what strikes me as you talk about the church is evolving and changing within Turkey and the larger world. At the same time, it reminds me of the slow food movement, or the slow that it takes time. And in a world that's so fast paced, mm-hmm. where you get your information quickly through a digital device and all that, mm-hmm. that there are still rituals and traditions that you stick to, you cling to, that you hold fast to. I'm kind of curious how you thought about it.
It depends on how we understand time, and how we understand change. The understanding of time in the East, you have already seen, it's totally different. This is why we can, for example, give you an appointment at 5 and come at 6 and with no hesitation and no problem, because the understanding of time is different in the East. This is one example. The other is how we understand depth. How we understand change. We understand changes that happen in depth rather than superficial changes. Changes in depth take longer, need more time, and need more patience, which these three elements are difficult for the Western civilization to understand. Whether this is good or bad, I cannot say, but this is a reality which we can accept, we have to accept and to understand. For us, changes are more important when they happen in depth than
sometimes you can't see the depth because you're too close up. Is that correct? And you just have to have faith that depth will reveal itself over time?
In West, you need things happen quickly, now, immediately. This is not the way things happen here. For example, this is not the way it happens in Turkey. The way that the present prime minister started changing Turkey to the right direction of modernization and democratization. It was successful because it was not quick. It was in-depth, well-planned, step-by-step, with patience and understanding. This is why Erdogan is a very successful prime minister, and this is why he won 3 elections with a rising percentage of votes. And this is why we have confidence that the things that we expect to happen for us, for our community, for the rights of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, will happen, but not that quickly. It will happen step by step. We have patience, we can wait. We are planning with the perspective of eternity than with the perspective of the next election politically. This is the mentality of the church. This is the spectrum of understanding of time that we have as church. for us, it is not, for me, for example, it is not important. Of course, it could be much more welcome if the school were open tomorrow, but more important for me is that the school reopens. Maybe not in my time, in the next abbot's time, but the school must reopen. And this is a steadfast decision we have, and this is the direction we are working without any hesitation.
And Istanbul, can't help but notice, is growing tremendously, mm-hmm. and it's growing down the coast, and as it grows, it seems to me the monastery at the top of the hill
is an oasis.
It's more visible.
It's an oasis in a desert of beton and stones.
And the visual presence in ways that maybe many people, citizens of Istanbul, had never realized before.
Yeah. Well, it, sometimes it's a scandal for some category of people that in this so Islamic and Turkish city, there are so huge and maybe, if I may use the word provocatively, glorious buildings belonging to another religion. So this was the reason that we lost the other monastery we had in this island. On this island we had two monasteries. This is the one. In this monastery was established the theological school, as I told you, and in the other monastery was established the commerce school of the Greek minority of the Ecumenical Patriarchate in Istanbul. But in the year 1944-45, when the whole world was busy with the Second World War, the then government, the Turkish government, blackmailed the Ecumenical Patriarchate to give one of the two buildings to the state, just like this. So we had to make the choice, and we kept the theological school. We, historically, we face this reality that when there is a growing majority and when there is a... is it okay? I think we exceeded 15 minutes.
I'll close with just with the final big question. Is there a particular story, an idea that that gives you a lot of hope as you proceed forward, something that you've experienced in your 18 months, whether it's through your diocese or through this school?
There was something that happened that really I accepted as a sign of God. When I was a deacon, I baptized somebody who came from this area and said that he was Greek origin and he wanted to go back to his roots and to be baptized Christian. We baptized him, and after 15 years, the Holy Synod elected me as a bishop of this area, of origin of this person that I baptized. And so he was my first Christian faithful. I see this as a sign of God for the future.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
I know it's a busy day.
It's a really busy day.
Which just allows us to
work with this?
It's a release.